From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The recent beheading videos posted by ISIS showed journalists James Foley and Stephen Sotloff dressed in orange, like the orange jumpsuits some detainees in Gitmo are still required to wear.
The image around the world remains that orange jumpsuits equals Guantanamo.
Today, New York Times reporter Charlie Savage, who went to Gitmo last month, explains the political reasons Gitmo remains open in spite of President Obama's promises to close it. Savage says some of the structures are decaying, a couple have been closed and look like ghost prisons.
The original Camp X-Ray, where the famous one where everyone was brought in 2002 with the sort of kennel-like cages, is overrun by vines and wildlife, boa constrictors and banana rats.
Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by the Mark Turner Quartet, and David Bianculli reviews the new documentary series, The Chair. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the videos posted by ISIS, the two kidnapped American journalists who were beheaded were dressed in orange, like the orange jumpsuits associated with detainees at Guantanamo Bay. My guest, Charlie Savage, made a reporting trip to Gitmo last month. He made his first trip there in 2003 and has written extensively about the prison. He wrote an article published in Sunday's New York Times describing how sections of Guantanamo are decaying while some buildings have been abandoned, what conditions are like for detainees, how expensive it's become to keep Gitmo open, and the political reasons it remains open in spite of President Obama's pledge to close it. There are currently 149 detainees there. 79 have been recommended for transfer, but there are obstacles standing in the way. There are no plans to release the other 70 who are considered high-value detainees. Savage is a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He covers presidential power and national security legal policy matters. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his 2007 reporting for the Boston Globe on presidential signing statements. Charlie Savage, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me back.
Both of the journalists who were beheaded by ISIS were dressed in orange, like the orange uniforms the prisoners in Gitmo have to wear. What has Gitmo come to symbolize to Islamist groups?
Well, it's less to Islamist groups, I think, than to the Muslim world in general, as well as to non-Muslims, but who are sort of civil liberties-minded people. I think for a long time, Guantanamo has been a symbol of early post-9/11 Bush administration war on terror policies in which prisoners were held without trial, still, of course, being held without trial today, but were also tortured. And the early photographs out of Guantanamo, which were actually not even taken by a reporter or a journalist, but were taken by the military and distributed of those first prisoners arriving at Camp X-Ray and lining up, kneeling before the fences in their bright orange prison garb, have become sort of iconic images of a very aggressive response in the handling of prisoners taken in the war on terror under the Bush administration. Guantanamo continues to remain open despite President Obama's efforts to close it. Most of the prisoners actually don't wear orange anymore, only those who disobey the rules. But I think the image around the world remains that orange jumpsuits equals Guantanamo. Guantanamo orange is even sort of a phrase you hear sometimes. You see protesters wearing orange jumpsuits, and I think that ISIS was trying to exploit those sentiments when it dressed the two journalists in orange before beheading them.
So, as you say, President Obama has pledged to close Gitmo, and last year he pledged to revive his efforts to close Gitmo. And he's acknowledged that it's become an anti-American symbol. Has his pledge to close Gitmo been lip service, or has he really actively been trying to close it?
Well, he's been actively trying, but in sort of in fits and starts that then go quiet. And basically, there's two buckets of people there. There's the people the U.S. government doesn't have an interest in holding but is having trouble getting rid of because they come from troubled areas. And there's the people that the government wants to hold on to just somewhere else. And early in his first administration, the State Department under a diplomat named Dan Freed ran around the world and found new homes for a lot of the people in the bucket they wanted to get rid of. And then Congress put in some fairly severe restrictions on conditions that had to be met before a transfer could occur and also barred the transfer into the U.S. And that basically killed the transfer of low-level prisoners for 2 years, 2011 through the end of 2012. And no one was moving. And Obama still sort of said that it was his policy, but it was clearly not the priority. And in fact, they reassigned Dan Freed at the State Department and didn't replace him. So there was no one even, you know, actively working on it at a high level anymore. And then last year, there was a tremendously widespread hunger strike at the prison to protest the fact that they had sort of been forgotten. And that prompted Obama to say, this is crazy, we've got to resolve this situation. And he appointed a new diplomat, Cliff Sloan, at the State Department to revive that effort. And they've been working upon whittling down that population again. And there was a surge at the end of 2013 where about 10 or 11 prisoners who were low-level and on this sort of recommended for transfer list for years, in fact, got out. And it looked like momentum was picking up. But this calendar year, 2014, it is slowed to an absolute crawl again. There's just no doubting that it's faltered.
There is a fear of what happens when you release these detainees. And in fact, some of them who have been released in the past later engaged in militant activity. What do you know about that?
During the Bush administration, brought 700 plus detainees to Guantanamo, and only about 240 were left when Obama took office. So quite a few came and left under the Bush administration, and in part because it also was trying to close the place. And it also had these sort of large deals with certain countries. Like most of the Saudi detainees went back to Saudi Arabia under Bush in sort of one fell swoop. And some of them, they were supposed to go through a rehabilitation program, but some of them it didn't take, right? And they ended up going down to Yemen or going to fight elsewhere. Many of them ended up living quietly, but a few didn't. And the Obama administration has had a much more granular, detailed interagency process for reviewing each detainee as an individual and sorting them into those recommended for transfer or not. Obama, I believe, has transferred 83, and of those, 5 supposedly have participated in terrorist or insurgent activity after their release, and 2 more are suspected of. So of the Obama bunch, if 83 were released and 5, let's take it at its face value, participated in terrorism or insurgency activity, or maybe as many as 7. Of course, that means the bulk of them are living quiet lives, but there's no doubt that there is a risk each time that it may not take, just as when someone gets out of prison for ordinary crime, there's a risk that they may do something again in the future. And so this is sort of overlaying this discussion of, if we have these guys already, shouldn't we just keep holding on to them, even if the bulk of them may not be a problem in the future? And that, I think, it creates a certain political or bureaucratic impediment. It now takes an affirmative decision by a particular government official to let them go. And under provisions enacted by Congress, that official is the Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel. And that means that, you know, if there's a 5% chance or whatever it is, 7% chance that any particular detainee may get into trouble afterwards and kill someone, let's say, there is someone who you can trace it back and you see their name and their signature on the paper saying, I agree that it's in our interest to let this person go. And that creates a tremendous amount of bureaucratic risk aversion. You know, no one wants to be the person who let the detainee go who causes a problem later. And so that's where we get to some of this tremendous difficulties.
The Obama administration is pulling out American troops from Afghanistan, and that war, the American part of that war in Afghanistan, is supposed to officially end next year. What legal questions does that raise about the detainees in Gitmo who are detainees from that war in Afghanistan after 9/11?
The government is clearly bracing for, they know it's coming, a new wave of habeas corpus lawsuits by the lawyers representing the detainees at Guantanamo, who will make the case that that war at least is over. And that means it's time to send home the prisoners of war. And the government, we already know what the government's argument will be. They will say, well, we may be done with our war in Afghanistan, but we're not done with the war against Al-Qaeda. That's sort of, and its associated forces. That is disconnected from the chunk of real estate that is Afghanistan. It's in multiple places around the world, especially ungoverned spaces like parts of Yemen and Somalia and so forth. And that war continues, and so we continue to have the legal authority to hold these people without trial if we want to, or if we don't have a place to send them. But it's clear that the legal pressures are mounting. And in fact, earlier this year, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, in a very unusual move, appended to an order denying relief to a certain detainee commentary, sort of providing a roadmap for future litigation and saying, you know, the Supreme Court has never been asked to decide whether the law or the Constitution limits the duration of indefinite detention without trial in this war, in this conflict. And so that's an open question that is becoming more urgent as the years keep passing.
So usually when prisoners of war are released, there's a peace treaty signed, the war is officially over. It's unlikely we'll have a peace treaty with Al-Qaeda. So I mean, theoretically, the Al-Qaeda detainees could be there forever.
That's right. That's sort of one of the most uncomfortable elements about applying laws of war that were written for 19th and 20th century style conflicts, armed conflicts between nation states, to this different kind of war, as President Bush once called it. You know, a war against a transnational network of loosely affiliated terrorists who all sort of raise the Al-Qaeda banner or put that bumper sticker on what they're doing, but aren't really organized in a way in which you can have a president or a king at the end of the day say, okay, we are all going to stop fighting now. And the war ends and prisoners of war are repatriated. There can't be such a thing in this war. And that raises this uncomfortable question, because the idea of holding prisoners of war until the end of hostilities without trials, because they haven't committed crimes, they're just members of the enemy force, is supposed to be a humanitarian one. It's supposed to prevent armies from slaughtering their enemies when they come into their power, to prevent them from being a risk in the future. But this war may never end, and that suggests that what we're talking about instead could be life sentence without trial for simply being a member, deemed a member of this organization.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Charlie Savage. He's a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He has reported several times from Gitmo and frequently reported about Gitmo. He has an article this week called Decaying Guantanamo Defies Closing Plans. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Charlie Savage. He's a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He's reported extensively about Guantanamo and has reported several times from Gitmo. His article this week in the Times is called Decaying Guantanamo Defies Closing Plans. In your article, you report that based on the many interviews you did for this story, you found a split is emerging between State Department officials who appear eager to move toward President Obama's goal of closing Gitmo, and some Pentagon officials who say they share that ambition, but they're more wary about releasing low-level detainees. Can you talk about that split?
So the State Department has a diplomat named Cliff Sloan, who was appointed last year by President Obama as part of his efforts to revive this closure effort. And he has been going around the world. He has a Defense Department counterpart named Paul Lewis. And they've been talking to countries about potential deals to repatriate or more likely resettle those 79 detainees the United States doesn't want to keep holding and who were recommended for transfer for the most part 4 years ago. And so he's been coming up with these deals. In January, for example, the president of Uruguay offered to take six of these hard-to-repatriate detainees and resettle them in Uruguay. And Afghanistan wants to take the four remaining Afghans who are approved for release back. And Mauritania wants to take its remaining detainee who's on that list back. And there's other sort of deals like that in the works. And so they then develop a set of security assurances with those countries that would take the detainees in, which usually involves monitoring them and not letting them travel outside the country. And they bring those deals to the Pentagon because under the transfer restrictions imposed by Congress, as I mentioned, the Secretary of Defense must determine whether a particular transfer is a good idea. And so it's clear that Secretary Hagel is cautious, and some of his advisors, including General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, are more cautious when they're examining these deals about things like whether the country that has offered to take these men in really can live up to the security promises it's making. And it's understandable why, because it's Secretary Hagel who's signing the paper and who's making the final decision. so that if something does go wrong, it's him where the buck will stop for having let that person go. But the upshot has been that in calendar year 2014, only one low-level detainee has left Guantanamo. These other deals are just sort of dying on the vine. And he waited so long on the Uruguay offer I mentioned that came in last January, and the details were all worked out by March, that by the time he was ready to move this summer on it, the president of Uruguay no longer wanted to move forward with it, at least for now, because his own presidential election season had gotten too close. And so what had been sort of a momentum-building prospect that had inspired other South American countries to express interest, evidently, in doing likewise, instead has stalled out.
So that's an example of why the low-level detainees who the government has recommended for transfer have still been difficult to move out of Gitmo. But there's a different set of problems with the high-level detainees, the detainees who are still considered to be an active threat. And what are the issues facing them and what to do with them if Gitmo is closed?
So there's 70 detainees of the 149 that the government is not trying to release. They are 10 of them have been charged or convicted in a military commission, and these are the famous ones like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, people who are actually tied to a specific terrorist attack, in his case, 9/11. And then 60 of them have not been charged, but are still deemed too dangerous to release based on an individualized review of, you know, what they say and how they behave in the prison and so forth. So for Guantanamo to close, even if the government were to get rid of those 79 low-level detainees, it would still have to do something with these other 70. And President Obama's plan, since he doesn't want to release those who haven't been charged but are deemed dangerous, is to bring them to one or more military prisons in the United States, where he says, you know, look, we're all holding tons of terrorists in Florence, the Supermax prison. We had tons of prisoners of war during World War II on American soil. We can do that again, and at least the optics will change, which is Guantanamo itself will close. It'll be sort of starting over with a blank slate or a fresh slate. And secondly, it would be just dramatically less expensive because Guantanamo is exorbitantly expensive. But he can't bring anyone to the United States because part of the restrictions imposed by Congress after he became president were to bar the transfer of any detainee to the United States for any purpose, not for prosecution, not because there's a medical emergency, and not for continued detention at a military prison on domestic soil. So he would need Congress to change that law, although he's raised some questions about its constitutionality, for part two of his plan to close the prison to work. And so far, at least, especially House Republicans have been expressed no interest in changing that law. In fact, have expressed open hostility to his Guantanamo closure plans at all and say, in fact, new prisoners should be brought there and it should just be revived.
So the detainees who've been approved for transfer but are still in Gitmo, what legal rights, if any, do they have? They've been approved for transfer, and yet they're being indefinitely detained.
That's right. Well, so, you know, so an important sort of nuance to understand about this group is, and sometimes critics of Guantanamo sort of conflate being recommended for transfer with being innocent or with being cleared as if they were being held by mistake. And there were quite a, you know, some number of people in the mass that were brought to Guantanamo by the Bush administration who genuinely were just not part of al-Qaeda and were there by mistake. And most famously, there was a group of Chinese Uyghurs who just were not America's enemy but were stuck there because we couldn't send them back to China. This group is not that group. Since 2008, the detainees have had the right to habeas corpus lawsuits, and they've been had the right, therefore, to go to court and say to the judge, I'm being held by mistake. You got the wrong guy. I was just there as a missionary or a case of mistaken identity. I'm not part of al-Qaeda. I never was. And can I go home, please? And judges have looked at the evidence and decided whether to order them freed or allow them to continue to be detained. And so the group that is there now are legally detainable, according to our court system, because they are, in fact, members of the enemy force, whether they're low level or high level. But the ones that are low level the government may have a legal right to hold them, but an interagency task force of national security agencies unanimously decided that there was no actual reason to keep paying this enormous expense and detaining them year after year because they were so low level, there's not much of a threat. Or maybe they're just, you know, have broken with Al-Qaeda and we believe them or so forth. So, you know, 10, 12 years after their capture, do we need to keep spending $3 million a year to hold this particular guy? Or if we can send him to a place that'll keep an eye on him, is that a better outcome for both sides? So the government has the right legally to keep holding them, say the courts, but it may not want to keep holding them. And that is the group that we're talking about.
So the 79 detainees who have been cleared for transfer, have they been charged with anything? Do we know why they're there?
So only 10 detainees of the 149 have been charged or convicted with a crime.
Charlie Savage will be back in the second half of the show. He's a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, where consumers can browse, buy, and schedule local services online. More at angieslist.com. From Source America, its Pathways to Careers program matches skills with employment options for people with significant disabilities. SourceAmerica.org. And from Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. This is NPR.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by the Mark Turner Quartet. We're listening to it now. David Bianculli reviews The Chair, a new documentary series on the Starz cable network in which two young filmmakers compete for prize money while making their films from the same script. And we continue our conversation with journalist Charlie Savage about Gitmo. He was there last month. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Charlie Savage, a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. We're talking about Guantanamo, the military prison holding detainees captured during the War on Terror. Savage has reported extensively about Gitmo. He made his first trip there in 2003 and was most recently there last month. He wrote an article published in Sunday's New York Times about how Gitmo is decaying and why it remains open in spite of President Obama's pledge to close it. Let's talk about your trip to Guantanamo in August. You write the infrastructure is decaying. These buildings were never intended for long-term use. Describe some of the conditions that you saw.
Sure. Well, so I've been going to Guantanamo since 2003, and it's always interesting to go back and sort of see how things are changing. the when I first went down there, all the prisoners were housed in this four-block area called Camp Delta, which were sort of open-air cell blocks and then one chunk of bunks. And Delta is now totally empty. They still use it for like a detainee health clinic and to house some books and so forth. But the detainees aren't there anymore, and it's sort of a ghost prison. And the original Camp X-Ray, where the famous one where everyone was brought in 2002 with the sort of kennel-like cages, is overrun by vines and wildlife, boa constrictors and banana rats, which are these giant marmots. And the detainees are, for the most part, are in concrete-walled buildings that were built in 04 and 06 called Camp 5 and Camp 6, which themselves are in pretty good shape, although the roof was leaking. But it's a sort of surrounding of 6. But the surrounding infrastructure is really falling apart. So a lot of the troops are housed in an area called Camp America, which are these sort of ramshackle shacks, 6 people to a room, bad ventilation, and there's no attached bathrooms. And it's not typically what you would have guards or, you know, military forces housed at a base outside of a war zone. And the industrial kitchen, which was actually built in the 90s when there were sort of migrant operations going on at Guantanamo, is a total wreck. The steel supports that hold the building to the ground floor have corroded in the harsh climate over the last 20, 30 years. You look up and there's holes in the roof, and the head cook tells me they have to put tarps over the dry goods when it rains because the water comes in. And it's clear the military is afraid that just one strong storm will blow that thing into the ocean, and then they won't have a facility to cook for the detainees or for the guard force.
In your latest article about Gitmo in the New York Times, you write about the quality of the medical facilities in Gitmo and the problems with that. You know, as the detainees age and the longer they're at Gitmo, apparently, you know, the more health problems they have. And give us the example of the detainee who had a heart problem and needed a stent. How is that dealt with?
So, as I mentioned earlier, the Congress has banned bringing a detainee into the United States for any reason, and that any reason includes health emergencies. But Guantanamo has a sort of small town type hospital on it, the sort of place that would serve a few thousand people. And there's a medical clinic they've built for the detainees that has, you know, the ability to do some basic things. But it's not like being near a city with sophisticated health care equipment and specialists readily available for anything that might arise. And they asked other Latin American countries, would you take a detainee and treat him if there was some problem, if there was a health emergency? And they all just basically weren't interested in doing that. And so they're stuck with a situation where when there's a need for more intensive health care, if it was a U.S. soldier who had that problem, they'd just put him on a plane and take him to Jacksonville. But if there's a detainee, they can't do that. And so their solution within the restrictions Congress has imposed is to import both equipment and specialists as needed, which, of course, takes some time and raises a question about what would happen in emergencies. A few years ago, there was a detainee who needed a stent placed in a coronary artery, and then they brought in a mobile cardiac catheterization lab, and then the detainee refused the procedure. And I'm not quite clear if it's the same lab or not, but eventually they had this lab sitting there in case some other detainee needed it, and none did, and it was sat outside year after year and decayed, and now this $1 million piece of equipment is just not made to exist in a place like Guantanamo for very long. Just a couple of weeks ago, they had to bring in a laser lithotripsy machine to take care of a kidney stone a detainee had, which is an outpatient procedure in the United States. But because they had to bring in this large device and the specialist, became quite an endeavor, both logistically and expensively. And so it's a problem, and it's one of the contributing factors to the huge infrastructure bill that the Southern Command, which oversees Guantanamo, says needs to be invested if Guantanamo is going to remain open, rebuilding housing for the troops, consolidating and enhancing medical facilities, rebuilding one of the camps, which reporters are not allowed to see, called Camp 7, where the high-value detainees like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed are held and apparently is built on unstable ground, causing the floors to buckle. Southcom has asked for $200 million to build all of this stuff there, which is awkward because the official policy is any minute now it's going to close.
Right. So this is really an issue for we taxpayers because we're paying a lot of money to keep Gitmo open.
That's right. This year, the taxpayers are paying more than $400 million to operate Guantanamo. So when you do the math, it works out to, you know, you divide the current bill by the 149 detainees who are there, and it's nearly $3 million a detainee. And if they were able to get rid of these 79 low-level ones they're trying to get rid of, and so it went down to a population of about 70 or so, of course, that would almost double because most of the costs are fixed. So $6 million is potentially a detainee. By comparison, the Bureau of Prisons says it costs about $30,000 a year to house an inmate in a maximum security prison in the United States. So it gives you an idea of just how expensive it is to have several thousand soldiers down there operating a prison in this remote location where everything has to be barged in or flown in. It's very expensive to build things. It's very expensive to keep people there. It's very expensive to repair things.
So you were in Gitmo in August. Tell us what you saw of living conditions there and whether living conditions for the detainees have gotten any better or worse since you started going to report from Gitmo.
Oh, well, since I first started going in 2003, there's no doubt that they've gotten better. They're in climate-controlled buildings now, and when it's very hot in August in Guantanamo, I'm sure you can imagine. And before, in 2003, they were in these open-air cages with huge fans that were sort of trying to keep things cool, but were much more primitive in all kinds of ways. The last time I was there before this visit was in April of 2013, and at that point, there had just been this huge hunger strike protest, which had caused Obama to turn his attention back to trying to get the low-level people out, at least, and close the place. And the guards force had raided the prison just a week before I'd gotten there, less than a week, and pushed all of those who were living in communal bunk areas into single-cell lockdown because they had been covering up video cameras and so forth, and they weren't quite sure what was happening in there. So that was a sort of extreme moment in the prison's history. Things have calmed down quite a lot in the past year because, at least at the end of 2013, people started moving out again. I think that caused a lot of the prisoners to sort of think, well, maybe if I keep my head down, I can get out someday too, whereas they had sort of lost hope and were in despair in 2013. So most of them are now back in communal conditions. And so if you walk through Camp 6, which is one of these concrete-walled buildings they've built down there, you can look at them through two-way glass or through surveillance monitors. There's sort of these two-tiered cell blocks surrounding a central concrete floor on which a metal table has been bolted. There's 22 cells, but only about 20 detainees in these cell blocks because they use a couple of the cells as like a pantry or a place to store books. And the detainees are here because these are the ones that comply with the rules. They're wearing white or brown, not orange, and they eat their meals communally. The guards just sort of wheel in a tray full of food and they can eat when they want to, and they can wander around most of the day, can go out to the recreation yard, can watch TV, pray together. And so it's obvious that that's sort of a better way to be than in single cell lockdown. The ones who break the rules mostly live in Camp 5, where they live in single cells. There's these sort of 6x8 cells where they have a bunk and have a toilet and a small sink, and they get looked at through the window every 1 to 3 minutes by a guard to make sure they're not doing something. And they have a sort of these trays that get pushed back and forth through their door when they want a bottle of water or something, and they have a very limited amount of access to recreation yards and so forth. But they can at least still talk to each other. What I'm not allowed to see, no reporter is allowed to see, is Camp 7, which they're very secretive about. They won't even tell you where it is, although if you look on Google Earth, there it is, so you know where it is. That's where the 15 former CIA prisoners like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed live. No reporter has ever been in there. This is the place where supposedly the floor is buckling, and if they're going to stay there for the long term, they need to spend $50 million on that alone to build a new one.
Gitmo has a prison library. The detainees who have been obeying the rules at Gitmo are allowed to watch television. What have you been able to learn about the books and the TV shows that are popular among Gitmo detainees?
So the detainees vary widely. There are some detainees who speak English and others who don't. There are some detainees who like Western culture and want to watch a Harry Potter movie or read a Harry Potter book or whatever. and others who don't. And one of the ways in which the communal cell blocks are divided, those are the ones where detainees who obey the rules may live and pray and eat together, and is that there are some where people would be don't want to see women who aren't covered up on the TV in the middle of the room, and others where they're fine with that. And so they're sort of further subdivided by their conservatism. I'm kind of fascinated by the Guantanamo Library. It has about 20,000 books, and it's part of this regular tour. It's sort of like a small branch library. It's got a few rooms, and they're divided up, and the detainees can't go there and browse the stacks. Instead, the library personnel put a bunch of books in bins and then cart them around to the cell blocks. And for a while, they had a budget and they were of a few thousand dollars a year, and they were buying more books. I think that budget is gone now, but people can still donate books through the Red Cross. The most popular books are said to be religious books, maybe not surprisingly, but they have a whole room full of Western books that you or I would be quite familiar with, ranging from Captain America comic books to The Hunger Games or The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or things of that ilk, as well as nonfiction books, apparently nature books and nature magazines with photographs of ocean or mountain or forest scenes are quite popular, maybe because they never see nature, as one of their lawyers told me. I actually made it's just as sort of a side project, a Tumblr, a blog, in which I took pictures of books in the detainee library, and reporters at other outlets who are colleagues of mine sort of joined in on that project. It's at gitmobooks.tumblr.com, and people seem to really be taken with it because it's so familiar and yet so alien at the same time to see these books that, you know, we have read or that, you know, might be on your kid's shelf, except it's circulating among detainees at Guantanamo Bay.
Well, Charlie Savage, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Charlie Savage is a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by tenor saxophonist Mark Turner, who Kevin describes as a thinking person's improviser. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Tenor saxophonist Mark Turner records a lot as a member of the trio Fly and as a sideman, but his new album is his first under his own name in over a decade. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Turner's a thinking person's improviser.
Tenor saxophonist Mark Turner has a reputation as a cool customer. His improvising is more about the instant composing of lucid lines than blunt self-expression. Turner's new quartet album, Lathe of Heaven, marks his third appearance on ECM Records this year, and the music he's written lends itself to that label's aesthetic. A lot of the action happens at thoughtful medium tempos, and there's some beautiful dissonance in the two-horn harmonies. But the players get a few moments to quicken their blood. Joe Martin is the bass player and Marcus Gilmore is on drums. Mark Turner tends to take his time and mostly avoids big emotive gestures some saxophonists rely on. His lean tone never gets in his way. Turner has a simpatico frontline partner in Avishai Cohen. The Israeli trumpeter's brash trio albums show his debt to Don Cherry, and his plump, round sound here, and the loving way it's captured, recall a fellow disciple, the Italian romantic Enrico Rava. Like Mark Turner, Avishai Cohen brings a sense of order to his playing. He can draw a line and follow it. Mark Turner's Lathe of Heaven takes its title from Ursula K. Le Guin's novel where the nature of reality keeps shifting. Turner says he thinks of this music as unfolding like a narrative, and you can hear the parallels. The music doesn't give up its secrets too fast as he parcels out his themes and sub-themes, establishing mood through the slow accumulation of details. The slinky melodies map out the terrain, foreshadowing the improvised action and interaction. That lets Mark Turner get a novelistic unity of effect. His clean plotting makes a cooler brand of jazz cool all over again.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Wondering Sound and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Lathe of Heaven, the new album by saxophonist Mark Turner's quartet. It's on the ECM label and comes out next week. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews a new TV documentary series that follows two young directors making movies from the same source material. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. This weekend, the Starz Cable Network presents a new 10-part documentary series about the making of a new movie. But it's a competitive situation, with two different young directors trying to make their own distinct films from the same source material. The series is called The Chair, and our TV critic David Bianculli finds it fascinating.
Here's where I stand on so-called reality TV. All those shows that are built around people misbehaving to get attention and claw for fame. In other words, all those Real Housewives shows and every Big Brother and any show like it. I have absolutely no use for. The talent and competition shows, the real ones like American Idol and The Voice and So You Think You Can Dance, I like a lot more. But after several seasons, the repetition of the format, and especially the emphasis on the judges rather than the contestants, usually wears me down. But over the years, the reality TV shows I've stuck with the most are the ones where the true creative process is most in evidence. For example, I still enjoy watching Lifetime's Project Runway, the fashion design competition, even though it's been around for 10 years now. Yes, the diva personalities are front and center, but at the end of each hour, there's a fashion show in which each designer gets to display what he or she can do or can't do. Maybe that's why I'm so intrigued by The Chair, the new Starz unscripted TV series, the first one from that particular network, that's all about the creative process in action. It's created by Chris Moore, who teamed with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon on Project Greenlight way back in 2001. That's the series that selected a young would-be filmmaker from a large group of applicants and documented his efforts to make his first feature film. Affleck and Damon aren't around for this ride, but plenty of others are. The credits for The Chair identify 20 executive producers and producers, including actor Zachary Quinto, who plays Spock in the new Star Trek films. But it's Moore, right from the start, who's the real voice of The Chair, and who explains at the outset what his 10-part series is trying to achieve.
The Chair concept really came out of Good Will Hunting before we ended up with Gus Van Sant, who directed the movie. We worked with a couple different directors. Mel Gibson was one, Michael Mann was one. And so I've always been fascinated by trying to set up a situation where you could actually see how two different directors would take the same material and turn it into two separate movies. And what if you could really show that to people?
The Chair does precisely that. It starts with the same script, a coming-of-age story written by first-time screenwriter Dan Schaffer about young friends from a small Pennsylvania town returning home for Thanksgiving midway through their first term at college. That script is handed to the two chosen directors, who almost surely by design couldn't be more different. One is Anna Martamucci, a graduate of NYU Film School who has written and acted before but never directed. The other is Shane Dawson, an internet phenomenon who's been making YouTube videos almost daily for 8 years, and whose young following numbers more than 10 million subscribers, more than many cable networks. Both of them instantly set out to adapt the original script, but with very different approaches. Anna rewrites the dialogue almost completely, and keeps rewriting so she can delay flying to Pittsburgh and starting her duties as a director. Oh, and at almost every point, Anna's emotions are set on raw. Even when she's in private, recording her thoughts in her own video diary.
Why did I say I would do this? I don't know. This is a terrible idea. I am. Rob, the guy, one of the guys making this show, told me that I should film myself when I'm in a fear pocket. And so I'm in one. I'm definitely procrastinating because I think maybe if I don't pack, then I just won't have to leave.
Shane, meanwhile, is the complete opposite. If he's suffering, it's from overconfidence. He takes the script and adds lots of risque jokes and sight gags, and he also adds himself.
Ever since I heard about this project, I just assumed that I would be in the movie because acting, directing, and writing is, that's my thing. I decided to cast myself as Scott. He's one of the lead characters. And I can't imagine my debut movie not having me in it, especially for the audience, because that's what they've been watching for so long.
The person who's capturing all this action and turmoil, as these two directors compete for the $250,000 prize and struggle to complete their respective movies, is Anthony Sacco, who followed and filmed the contestants on both Project Greenlight and the early years of Project Runway. He's very good at capturing his subjects off guard. And in The Chair, he even films them complaining about Chris Moore when they've forgotten all about the cameras and microphones. The first two episodes of The Chair, provided for preview, were lots of fun to watch, even though I didn't end up rooting for either of the fledgling filmmakers. Maybe you'll like one director more than the other, and eventually, one film more than the other. Because when The Chair is over, Stars will premiere the two films that were made as a result. I'll have to wait until I see them to render a verdict on the final product. But the filmmaker's journey in The Chair, that's a reality TV show I can actually and heartily endorse.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Yowei Shaw. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from eSurance, with an app that lets users manage their car insurance policies, update payment info, and handle claims at eSurance.com. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, with 25 years of Kids Count data on the well-being of America's children at datacenter.kidscount.org. And from the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the passion of NPR journalists all around the world whose stories take us there every day. This is NPR.
A president with a progressive economic agenda, a president devoted to keeping his country out of war, who decides he has no choice but to go to war, a president whose vision for peace is blocked by Republican legislators. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about President Woodrow Wilson with A. Scott Berg, whose biography of Wilson is out in paperback. Join us.